Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tom Lowenstein, author of The Trials of Walter Ogrod, The Shocking Murders, So-Called Confessions, and Notorious Snitch That Sent a Man to Death Row. We'll also talk with Kalamu Yasalam, author of The Magic of Juju, An Appreciation of the Black Arts Movement. Tom Lowenstein is the founder of the New Orleans Journalism Project, an organization that works with journalism students on stories related to criminal justice. Before that, he was the policy director and an investigator at Innocence Project New Orleans. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Trials of Walter Ogrod, The Shocking Murder, The So-Called Confessions, and Notorious Snitch That Sent a Man to Death Row. Tom Lowenstein, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much for having me.
This book is the story of a crime that took place a long time ago in Philadelphia in 1988. How did you get involved in this story?
I set out in 2001. I was working at Harvard for a professor named Robert Coles, who was what he called a social documentary writer. And he actually worked a lot in New Orleans.
Yes, he did.
And we taught The Moviegoer. We taught, what were the other New Orleans books? There was a lot of New Orleans stuff. So I was inspired by working with him. My idea was I picked death row inmates at random and I wrote them a letter, and the letter said, if you agree to do this with me, then I get to read your entire file. I'm going to interview you, your lawyer, the victim's family, the prosecutors, the police. I'm going to interview everybody involved in your case, and I'm going to write a narrative. And my idea was to write a narrative of the death penalty when it works. I had done some anti-death penalty work, and I had been involved with some wrongfully convicted men. But my idea was to be opposed to the death penalty. You have to understand how it works when it supposedly works well. So I wanted to write a narrative of two death penalty cases, pick them at random, and therefore I wasn't making any point. I was just going to tell two stories as they went and lay out the entire scope of how a death penalty case works. You know, killer caught, killer tried, killer convicted. And so I sent my two letters off, and one of them I sent to a man named Nick Yaris. And Nick wrote me back and said that he didn't want to do it. He said he was running out of appeals and didn't want to fight his case anymore, but he would give my letter to someone who might. So the next letter I got was from Walter Ogrod, and Walter said that he was innocent, and I didn't believe him, but I figured my rule stuck. I would follow whatever case came to me to its conclusion. So that's how I ended up on Walter's case. Nick Yaris himself was exonerated 2 years later. Turns out that he was in the process. He had a lot of lawyers at that point, and he shunted me off to someone who thought needed the help more. It wasn't that he didn't want to fight his case anymore. It was that he knew he had enough lawyers and he was okay and other people weren't.
How interesting.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about Walter when you first met him?
I didn't meet him for a couple of years. Uh-huh. So the initial process was just trying to understand the case. And his letters struck me as extremely matter of fact. He didn't say what the crime was fully. He didn't lay it all out. He didn't do any of the things that I expected from an inmate, which is to pour out his life story, tell me 17 excuses about himself. None of that happened. He just was very matter of fact. So I started looking into the case, and there are, you know, shall we say, big red flags with the case that instantly made me think perhaps he was telling the truth, that he might be innocent. But it still was a long process of tracking down, you know, all the information in the case and going over the whole thing before I really came to believe that he was innocent. But there were enough early signs that he was innocent that kept me going.
And so much of this is reading through paperwork,
yeah.
Piles and piles.
Yeah, that's the fun part.
That's the fun part?
Yeah. Yeah, we used to joke about it when I was at the Innocence Project. It's apparently some kind of character trait or flaw or something, but we all just loved it. You get these big old trial transcripts and you just immerse yourself in it, and then you track down old witnesses and, you know, read all the police statements and all that kind of stuff. It's fascinating. I can sort of look back and think, wow, I read a lot of stuff. How did I possibly? But as you go, it's just fascinating. I find all this stuff completely, you know, enthralling.
The one thing about this crime is that it's so horrible.
Yeah.
you have to describe it a bit, I think.
Yeah, so what happened in the case was a little girl named Barbara Jean Horn, who was about 4 and a half, was home with her stepfather on the day of the crime. Her mother worked downtown and worked all day, and her stepfather was a stay-at-home dad. And so she was just home. He was doing chores. She was in and out all day trying to find friends to play with. And then at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon was the last time her stepfather saw her. And he realized she was missing at about 4 in the afternoon. And they found her body at about 5:30 in the afternoon, about 2 blocks away in a TV box. So it was in some ways the worst nightmare kind of case that you can have. A small Right. child taken from in front of her home and killed in the neighborhood. It panicked the neighborhood. It panicked the city. It was front page news everywhere. And in terms of solving the crime, the man who carried this little girl's body in a TV box down the sidewalk was seen by 5 people and put the box down and walked away, and the box was opened 2 minutes later. So it was him. That was the man. He had the box, and he was right there.
Stunning.
And if a couple of people had made slightly different decisions, they would have had him right there. But he walked away, and they did an intense manhunt. Again, there were 5 witnesses to the case, and all 5 of them described the man as being between 5'6 and 5'8, sandy blonde hair, about 160 to 180 pounds. Walter Ograd is 6'2, 220 pounds with jet black hair. So eyewitness testimony is a complicated issue, and it's not Yes. nearly as straightforward as people think it is. But I did think when reading this, in this case, when you have 5 people describing essentially a very similar person, I think that's a good eyewitness description in general terms.
One of the things you do so well in this book is describe the emotional repercussions of a crime like that. I mean, you make the whole neighborhood come to life. Her parents, you really feel their pain. You feel the neighborhood's urgency and fear that grows as time passes, you know. And so that's really kind of a remarkable achievement of this book. It's the whole social construct around the crime. You know what I mean? Mm. But then going onward, you go into the police investigation, which is so interesting. Mm. How was that for you?
It was extremely important to me from the beginning that the victim and the victim's family be presented clearly in the book. My father was murdered when I was a kid. And I know to some level what that's like to go through. The victim in this book is Barbara Jean Horn. She was taken. She was murdered. So it was very important for me to get that right. And to go interview her parents was the hardest part of the whole thing for me, because I knew myself what it was like 20 years after my father was murdered to have someone show up and want to talk to me about the killer.
Of course.
And it's something to this day I have no interest in talking about. So it was a very emotional thing for me to contact the Fahys and ask them if I could come talk to them. And when I was finally able to find them and contact them and they agreed to talk to me, I went and spent 6 hours with them, and they were incredibly forthright. I mean, if you read the book, it's not necessarily a wonderful picture of them that emerges, but they were very honest. There were all kinds of questions. You know, I spent hours leading up to the interview trying to think, how am I going to ask them if they use drugs? Because a lot of people had told me they had. And I walked in and sat down, and they told me about it, and they told me what they did. So that was incredibly difficult and incredibly important to me. I felt there was no book if they wouldn't talk to me. If I couldn't bring the victim's family out, I wasn't sure if I would be able to, you know, to have a book in the first place.
So then when you finally did meet Walter, did you have a sense immediately that you had chosen well?
It's interesting because on the level of, again, as someone trying to write a book about a person on death row, there is no emotional, Walter doesn't have the ability to explain things emotionally, his emotional
Right.
life. On the one hand, it was a good thing for me because all the manipulation that I expected from the death row inmate, the you've got to help me, you know, trying to make me feel sorry for him, never happened. He never did any of that. He would never try to put hooks in me that way. But at the same time, if I, you know, interviewing Walter and I'd say, okay, well, Walter, tell me what it was like when, you know, when your parents got divorced. And he would say, what do you mean? Sad? You know, say, well, so, and that's where I started to think of him being on the autism spectrum.
And at the end of this book, he's still in prison.
Yes.
He'll turn 52. Mm-hmm. This year makes 25 years.
That's right. He was put in April of 92.
And you make this point that evidence that could prove his innocence or guilt has still not been explored.
Yeah. Well, the Philadelphia DA's office is famous for digging in. There was a gentleman named Tony Wright. Anthony Wright was exonerated, I think, last year. And he gave a false confession to the same detective, Marty Devlin, who took Walter's false confession around the same time. And he was proven innocent by DNA testing. And he stayed in prison for 2.5 more years while Philadelphia fought his exoneration. And they finally took him back to trial. Even with DNA proving he was innocent, they took him back to trial and he was acquitted. So it's a very, very tough landscape up there. I've learned enough from working down in New Orleans. I know people that were in doing life in Angola who are out now with one of the claims that Walter has, you know, and he has 20. So I do think that this conviction isn't sustainable in the end, that he will get out. But Philadelphia apparently has no interest in figuring out the truth of these things. And the DNA, the fingernail scrapings from Barbara Jean, the murder victim, are in the evidence locker, as are swabs from her body. So you could take it out. And I was at a hearing in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, and the DA said, well, there's no point in testing. It could be anybody. And I thought, well, no, if it's Walter, then obviously Walter did it. There were two men that were the subject of a grand jury investigation in this case. One of them, the police followed for 6 months. They were so sure he was the murderer, and they never got enough evidence to indict them. If it's either of those two men, then we know who did it. There's even another man named Ray Sheehan who confessed to the murder of a different little girl in the same neighborhood around the same time. And Ray Sheehan had been identified by one of the witnesses in Barbara Jean's case as the person carrying the TV box. So you have an eyewitness identification of a man who's in prison for murdering a little girl. What if it's his DNA under her fingernails? That would tell us a lot, wouldn't it? And then, of course, there's a DNA database now. If they took that DNA and tested it, this happens a lot in cases now. They'll find out that, you know, 6 years later, the person who did this did something else somewhere and his DNA is on record. So there really are at least five good answers that that DNA could give us. Now, it may not give us any of them.
And it's so frustrating to be the one person who wants to know so badly and is unable to make it happen. Now, I admire so much the way this work is so intensely personal to you. I wonder if you'd say a few words about your father.
Sure. My father was Al Lowenstein, and he was a political activist in the 60s. He worked on the Dump Johnson movement, and he worked on the civil rights movement in the South, and he was in Congress for a brief time. And then later, he was the special ambassador for human rights at the United Nations. And he was murdered when I was 10 by a former colleague. One of the things my father had done during the civil rights movement was to recruit Northern students to come to Mississippi and register voters. And one of those young men from Stanford came down and I believe was beaten and was in a house that got blown up and became radicalized and then became a paranoid schizophrenic and murdered my father because he thought my father was wiretapping him through his teeth and that kind of stuff.
And you and your sister both have become active in the anti-death penalty.
Yes. I did anti-death penalty stuff for a while because in Massachusetts, where I was living, we didn't have the death penalty, but there was a move to bring it back. And someone wrote an op-ed piece in the paper saying, if you don't support the death penalty, you don't care about murder victims' families. And I thought, well, that's not true. I'm a murder victim's family member, and I oppose the death penalty. So I reached out and offered to write an op-ed piece, and I did. And then the death penalty got defeated on a tie vote in the Massachusetts legislature. It was credible. And then I was asked to do some organizing and do some speaking against the death penalty.
So talk about the work you're doing with the New Orleans Journalism Project.
Well, so the idea behind the Journalism Project is we have sort of a two-layered system that we want to put in place. We have an editorial team, which is led by Katie Rechtall, who's the wonderful local journalist. And what we're trying to do on that end is to train advanced journalism students on how to be good journalists through criminal justice stories. The other aspect of it, which I'm also very excited about, is to work with younger students, which would be high school and young college students, to understand the criminal justice system in New Orleans, understand where it comes from, why it is the way it is, how the media covers it, and mostly to empower these students to tell their own stories. Because New Orleans is such a magnet for national media, and everything that happens down here is so studied. I've lived here for long enough now to be able to understand what it's like to read the national media about the local situation. It's often correct, and a lot of wonderful writers who work on it. But also, I feel very strongly that these stories need to be told by the people that live them every day. And to come into New Orleans, I taught at the Bard Early College New Orleans program.
Ah, yes.
And I taught a class on criminal justice to 25 African-American students. And I've just told them, you all are going to teach me more than I'm going to teach you. But here's the basics of how the system got to be the way it is. So the idea is to empower some of those kids to tell their own stories. And I also think that just for journalists, working criminal justice stories is an incredibly good way to learn your chops.
What great work. You're going to create a legion of transcript reading journalists.
One can only hope.
Which would be good for us all. We've been talking with Tom Lowenstein, whose new book is The Trials of Walter Ograd, The Shocking Murder, So-Called Confessions, and Notorious Snitch That Sent a Man to Death Row. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Assalam is one of New Orleans' most prolific artists, editors, and best-known teachers. He's the author of 5 books of poems, numerous essays, and 13 plays, as well as documentaries. For the past 9 years, he's been the director of Students at the Center, an independent writing program in New Orleans area high schools. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Magic of Juju, An Appreciation of the Black Arts Movement. Kalamu, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you. You're the steadfast doyen of literature in New Orleans, well, particularly in terms of text.
I'm reading all the time.
Now, I remember we spoke last fall when Dillard's hosted a conference about the Black Arts Movement with a bit of a New Orleans focus. But your book takes a broad historical look at the entire Black Arts Movement.
Yes. That was part of the purpose, not only to look at from a standpoint of a critic, the Black Arts Movement was a national movement. And what I wanted to do was give people an idea of the breadth of it and also of the depth of it, so that when I looked for the publications, I went to the original mastheads and listed all the editors and what have you. And I think anybody that just surveys the book, it's one thing to agree or disagree with the content of many of the work, and it's another thing to know the extent of the movement and to understand that many, many, many people developed out of this. This was a seedbed, if you will, for modern African-American literature.
Oh, I know. And I love that line from Entezaki Shange, which she says, I'm the daughter of the Black Arts Movement.
Right.
Even though they didn't know they were having a girl.
Right.
That's one of my favorites. Now, one of the things that you bring home so beautifully in this book is just the range of it all. I mean, producers of every kind of art, theater, poetry, fiction, essays, film, and the means of publishing, which is something I know you understand as well as I do, and then visual and performing arts. You put so much emphasis on that, and that makes reading about this so much fun.
Well, I can't look at it in the same way somebody that's, you know, for whom all of this is something new, but I can look at it from the standpoint of saying, if you want to help people understand something, do a survey map so that they can later go back if they're interested in a particular thing and know where to look for the details. I was not trying to give a detailed explanation. I was not trying to give a critical review of the literature or anything. I was basically trying to map the terrain in a larger sense so that people could go back. For instance, many people have no idea that one of the major thrusts in terms of Black theater was located here in New Orleans, but started in Jackson, Mississippi, in terms of the Free Southern Theater.
And you were very much involved in that. One of the great things about reading this book and knowing you is knowing how much of this book you lived. You lived it. Didn't that just make you feel like $1 million kind of to write that down?
Well, at the time, when you fall in love, you have no idea what or if there will be a family that comes out of it and what the children will do and the grandchildren. To you, it is the experience of love, you know. Mm-hmm. Later, people will come back and say, as with Alexandre Dumas and his son, the son picked up the pen after his father and blah, 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 blah. Well, the same way with the Black Arts Movement, people will come back and say, wow, so-and-so was in it, and now you look at this. And for instance, Mary Baraka, who was one of the major people, in fact, was the person who named the Black Arts Movement, his son becomes the mayor of the city. And no one could have predicted that at the time, but when you lay it out, it seems logical.
Right. So talk a little bit about, you know, your work here in New Orleans with friends like Tom Dent and others.
Tom was not just a friend. When I came out of the Army in June of 68, I ended up joining the Free Southern Theater. And it was there that I met and became friends with Tom Dent. And then a cohort, we edited publications together. We did workshops and what have you together. And then I really began to understand something. I had thought of myself as a Black writer, but not a New Orleans writer.
Interesting.
Under Tom's guidance, I became a New Orleans writer. You're not just a New Orleans writer because you were born here or you grew up here or you went to school here. I mean, is New Orleans and the culture of New Orleans and the history of New Orleans, is that part of your focus? And do you draw anything from that? That's what would make you a New Orleans writer. Tom helped me understand your environment. And New Orleans, unbeknownst to the world, is in many ways the cradle of African-American literature, creative literature. The first anthology yes. of poetry, Less Than L, was published here in 1845. And what happens is, because the publishing world up through the 20th century was focused in New York, the people left here and went to New York to try and make a mark. In the black community, however, the publishing world was focused in Chicago.
Yes.
And that became the epicenter, particularly because of Johnson Publications, that became the epicenter in terms of physical location. But then, when you look at the Black Arts Movement, there were so many different places that were publishing centers for different things. The West Coast, New York, Chicago, Detroit. And then when you throw in theater, you have to come down south to New Orleans.
Well, we should say that this book, The Magic of Juju, was published by Third World Publications, which is one of the great outgrowths of the Black Arts Movement.
Right, yes.
This is a book that it's also a great chronicle of joy and intellectual energy and vital conversations and relationships. I mean, even if you're just interested in the history of publishing, you should be reading this book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, hopefully it'll be around a while and it will help people, give them some idea of where to look. It's almost like, oh, you want to study baseball? You don't know who Babe Ruth is?
Exactly. You devote all these energies to other people. You're very generous with your time and teaching. And I wonder if you'd talk just a bit about what the Black Arts Movement did for you personally, as a man, as a writer. How did it make you feel about yourself when you finished looking at all this and your part in it?
Am I finished?
This is a little chance to do a victory dance, Kalamu. Come on.
You make it sound like the casket is closed.
No, baby. No, no, no.
But I've never thought in terms of me except as a part of some we. We used to have a saying, you know, it's not about you.
Yeah, I've heard you say that.
It's about us. It's about we, you know. And as long as you think it's just about an individual or the individual's career or what have you, it rises, it falls, it may rise, it may not rise, you know. You may not have put enough baking soda in it or whatever, you know. But if it's about we and you survive, there's always something to celebrate.
Well, there's certainly a lot to celebrate in this book. I was very moved reading it. And it made me want to seek out the authors I didn't know as well as I should have. There's a lot of food for thought in this book.
And one other thing I will say about the book is that I had the vision for what I wanted to do, and I kept expanding it. And I said, you know what? Most people don't know any of these folk, so we need some pictures. And Eugene Redmond, whom I know very well, has made a career. He's a writer, but he's also made a photographer, and he's made a career. And so we have close to 100 and some photographs from the period, not just a shot of a person, but from that period. You get to see Toni Morrison, I mean, again, people don't even think about, well, Toni Morrison and the Black Arts Movement, how does that, you know?
Made me go back and look at Shrovetide in old New Orleans.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so the photographs really, well, they made a beautiful book for you. It is a beautiful book, outside and in, you know?
So we tried. We tried to make something that would be a starting point rather than an end point.
Right. Well, I loved reading it, and I thank you for it. So,
and thank you for doing what you do, because without this type of exposure for the literature in general, it can't develop. It can't find new audiences. It can't build on audiences. You have to have this type of experience. And given the time period we live in, where the internet has replaced the library, a lot of this material is available, but we don't know what to look for.
Yes. We need to send people back to the library, as you know. So. We've been talking with Kalamu Yasalam about his wonderful new book, The Magic of Juju, An Appreciation of the Black Arts Movement. Don't miss it. Kalamu, thank you so much.
Thank you for what you do, and thank you for this discussion.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tulane professor Carissa Hogeberg discusses and signs Women Against Abortion inside the largest moral reform movement of the 20th century. Tuesday, May 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Pamela Arsenault discusses Guidebooks to Sin, the Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans, at the meeting of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library, Wednesday, May 3rd at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Cartoonist Michael Fry reads from and signs his most recent middle grade adventure, How to Be a Supervillain, Wednesday, May 3rd at 4:30 at Octavia Books. And don't forget to visit the Jazz Fest book tent while you're out at the fairgrounds this Thursday through Sunday. It's next to the CD tent and features a full selection of New Orleans books, with authors appearing throughout all 4 days to sign their books. It's put together by the New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers Association and proceeds benefit literacy efforts. Here are the authors who'll be signing this weekend. Thursday, May 4th, Carolyn Gertis signs an oral history of the Ninth Ward from noon to 1. Niaki Harrison signs My Lou's Special Hair from 1 to 2. Friday, May 5th, David Capello signs The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans, and the Making of the Modern Retail World, from 2 to 3. Philip Gould and Herman Fusilier sign Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls, Past and Present, from 4 to 5. Saturday, May 6th, Jerry Strahan signs Lucky Dogs, from Bourbon Street to Beijing and beyond, from noon to 1. Tom McDermott signs 5 Lines, No Waiting, from 2 to 3. Laura Cayouette signs The Hidden Huntsman, from 3 to 4. Stacy Balkan signs Lost City Museum, from 4 to 5. And then on Sunday, May 6th, Todd Michael St. Pierre signs Chicory and Rue, The Creole Mouse and the Cajun Mouse, noon to 1. Kathleen Shrink signs A Dog Steals Home, from 1 to 2. Elizabeth Pierce signs Drink Dat New Orleans, from 2 to 3. And Fred LeBlanc signs Fred, the New Orleans drummer boy, from 3 to 4. Josh Funk reads from and signs his children's book, The Case of the Stinky Stench, Friday, May 5th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Joanne O'Sullivan signs her children's book, Between Two Skies, Saturday, May 6th at 3 at Octavia Books. And Facebook COO Cheryl Sandberg signs Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy, and appears in conversation with Mary Madeline, Tuesday, May 9th at 7 at the Academy of Sacred Heart, NIMS Fine Arts Center, 4401 St. Charles Avenue. This is a ticketed event. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for tickets. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.